It's not about being poor, is not about like a lack of morality. It's about a lack of money, and humanizing the face of it and then challenging it.
Right. So she had another amazing quote, again, with such wit. Money does not bring happiness, only the wherewithal, perhaps, to endure its absence. She understood that on a basic level, people just needed higher wages and more money, basically. And to make this into a moral or personal vendetta against the poor was an obscenity. And she dedicated much of her life to creating media around that. And in our work in the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, to bringing at this point probably thousands of people, including working poor people, back into the fold, teaching her methods.
Could you talk about some of the big stories that have come out of the project since Barbara founded it?
Yeah, I mean, I can also talk about some of the ones she was most proud of, because they're now at the front of my mind as I'm sort of mourning. One of them was a writer, Darrell Wellington, who sold his own plasma. And so he wrote about that experience of selling his own plasma and then widened it out to the plasma industry. There's a writer who herself is financially insecure, who wrote about taking in an unhoused couple as part of a social program, kind of an NGO program, and what that meant, and her own phobias and her own experience of that. So I feel like these are some of the stories that I'm most proud of, because they have the ring of truth and the intensity of human experience, coupled with an understanding, like, how do we destigmatize unhoused people? Oh, maybe we need to spend some time with them. And also, both of those stories had a sort of dark humor that was her signature.
Her last book, in fact, was about dying, wasn't it, Alyssa? We have about 10 seconds.
Yeah, it was about dying. And I think the profound takeaway for me from that was that each of our deaths is part of a broader social struggle. And the saga will continue after we go.
That book was called Natural Causes, and of course, the one she is most famous for, Nickel and Dimed. Alyssa Court, friend and colleague of Barbara Ehrenreich, again, our condolences, and as well to Ben Ehrenreich, her son, and to Rosa Brooks, her daughter, and to so many others who cherished her whole family. Alyssa Court, Executive Director of Economic Hardship Reporting Project. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, be brave.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO, because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing boing.
KBOO's Board of Directors is delighted to invite all KBOO members to the annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections. The meeting will be held on Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. A Zoom link and call-in access will be provided to those who are unable to attend in person. This is the opportunity for all members to meet the candidates, get station updates, and make their voices heard. Again, that's KBOO's annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2022.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
Portland's favorite talk radio at 8 on Fridays returns at 8 on Friday, September 16th. Tammy and Althea are back to bring you thoughtful insights, colorful commentary, activist interviews, and community conversation. Minding it, bridging it, filling it in. The Gap returns to KBOO on Friday, September 16th at 8 a.m.
The Gap. The Gap. The Gap.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kboo.org to learn more. That's program@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders with disabilities are suing the city for allowing tents on sidewalks. New Omicron boosters make their way to Oregon. And in international news, Brazil's upcoming presidential election and what it means for our climate future. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 7th, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Ten Portlanders with disabilities have filed a lawsuit against the city of Portland, which they say violated the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, by allowing tents on the sidewalk. The lawsuit was filed Tuesday, and it says that the city's failure to remove debris and homeless camps from sidewalks prevents people with mobility disabilities from having access to safe walkways. The plaintiffs say they've had to ride their wheelchairs in the street sometimes to stay clear of camps on the sidewalks. They also say they've been harassed by unhoused Portlanders because they have to pass through crowded sidewalks. The suit calls for the city to immediately sweep campers off all city walkways, but Portland is subject to a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that says cities can't remove homeless people from public spaces if they don't have adequate shelter space. The plaintiffs have an answer for that, though. Their suit demands that Portland construct or purchase shelter space for every person swept. The lawsuit represents Portlanders from different neighborhoods across the city, but it cites the Pearl District, Old Town, and Downtown as particularly challenging areas. Not mentioned, however, are houseless Portlanders who have disabilities themselves. In 2019, 62% of unsheltered people in Multnomah County reported having a disability. So are you ready for your next COVID booster? They arrive in Oregon this week. That's according to Oregon health officials. But they are asking for your patience as they roll them out to the public. The Oregon Capital Chronicle reports that the state expects to receive about 150,000 doses initially of an updated bivalent vaccine. Bivalent refers to the fact that the one vaccination will target the original strain of the coronavirus, as well as the two latest and most infectious variants, BA4 and BA5. Those last two currently are the most dominant form of the virus as well, and have caused the majority of recent infections in both Oregon and the rest of the country. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention approved these new booster doses by Moderna and Pfizer and BioNTech last Thursday. They were then endorsed by a West Coast scientific group representing Oregon, California, Washington, and Nevada. This paved the way for vaccinations to begin in those states. KGW is reporting that the Pfizer shot is approved for people ages 12 and older, and the Moderna booster is for people who are at least 18. Either shot can be given regardless of the brand of vaccine the person had before. Oregon health authorities and local outlets plan to start setting up clinics and making the booster available to all who are eligible. They advise that it may take a while for everyone who wants a booster to get one. For more information about who is eligible and where to get your booster, check the Oregon Health Authority website at oregon.gov/OHA. American adults are saying that they need more education to get ahead in their careers. That's according to a recent survey. Oregon provides a number of opportunities for people to get more training and education. Eric Tegetoff has more.
Nearly half of Americans say they need more education to advance in their careers, according to new research. The Strata Education Network and Gallup survey found 46% of adults without a degree or not currently enrolled in college say additional education is needed to get ahead. Julia Steinberger is the Office of Workforce Investments Director with the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Particularly as we see shortages in qualified candidates for some of these good-paying, competitive jobs, I think folks just see the opportunity out there and know that they need that education and training in order to capitalize on those opportunities.
While there's the more traditional college route available to people, Steinberger also notes Oregon has made investments to ensure apprenticeships are widely available. She says the state also is working with businesses to create training from employers through the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. Steinberger says going back to college can cost more for adult learners, who are likely to have more responsibilities than a student coming out of high school.
The potential lost opportunity cost of wages if you're stepping out of the workforce, cost for healthcare, childcare, transportation, housing, etc.
This year, the Oregon legislature approved a $200 million education package known as Future Ready Oregon. Steinberger says it includes a training program from community colleges that helps people enter the education system and exit easily to find a job.
It's really designed to be a set of stackable credentials that will ultimately lead to a degree, but allows folks to sort of get on and off the road whenever they're able to.
The Future Ready Oregon package includes an array of programs, including workforce training grants and supports for apprenticeships in the state. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Anti-Defamation League has identified over 30,000 people who are connected to the far-right extremist group known as the Oath Keepers. Their members were formerly in the military or held public office. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on that story.
The names of hundreds of U.S. law enforcement officers, elected officials, and members of the military have appeared on membership rolls of a far-right extremist group accused of playing a major role in the January 6th U.S. Capitol insurrection. The Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism reviewed more than 38,000 names on leaked Oath Keepers membership lists and identified more than 370 people it believes currently work in law enforcement agencies and more than 100 who appear to be recent members of the military. It also identified more than 80 people who were running for or served in public office as of last month. The report states, quote, "Even for those who claim to have left the organization when it began to employ more aggressive tactics in 2014, it is important to remember that the Oath Keepers have espoused extremism since their founding, and this fact was not enough to deter these individuals from signing up," end quote. Appearing in the Oath Keepers database does not necessarily prove that a person was an active member of the group or shares its ideology. However, the Associated Press believes these data raise concerns about the presence of extremists in positions tasked with enforcing laws. The AP did reach out to people on the list. Some said they were briefly members years ago and are no longer affiliated with the group, and some that they never were dues-paying members at all. The Oath Keepers were founded in 2009. They are a far-right militia group supporting strong conspiracy theories. They believe the federal government wants to strip citizens of their civil liberties. They have listed so-called orders they will not obey, a compendium of imagined threats coming from the government, such as imposing martial law, seizing all firearms, and putting resistors into detention or concentration camps. They commonly attempt to recruit current and former military, police, and first responders, and paint their followers as protectors against tyranny. The group asks its members to vow to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. More than 24 people associated with the Oath Keepers, including its founder, Stuart Rhodes, have been charged in connection with the January 6th Capitol attack. But following January 6th and Rhodes' arrest, the group has struggled to keep members, according to Rachel Carroll Rivas, Interim Deputy Director of Research with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan Greenblatt also said, quote, "To know that members of this group have permeated key aspects of civil society should serve as a wake-up call to people of all political persuasions that extremists hell-bent on destroying our democratic norms are making inroads across the country." End quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Not all of the candidates in Washington State's primaries with ties to the far right are moving on to the general election, but there are some who will be. Many have expressed doubts about the results of the 2020 election and are connected to white nationalist figures. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Washington State's primary results have diminished fears of a far-right insurgency in the state's elections. But there are still concerns that 2020 election misinformation and extremist ties will play a role in the November midterms. Across the state, candidates for county auditor, who manage elections, have denied the legitimacy of the 2020 election results. Democratic State Representative Emily Wicks of Everett says that could have implications for future elections.
That's really concerning. People that don't want to follow the rule of law, that don't want to accept the results of the 2020 election, are going to take over and could have some weight in that.
On the congressional level, Joe Kent has advanced in the 3rd District, which covers parts of southern Washington. Kent believes the 2020 election was won by former President Donald Trump and has won Trump's endorsement. His campaign did not respond to a request for comment. Neither did the Washington State Republican Party. There also are concerns about the ties between some state legislators and the far right. According to a recent report, more than 20% of state Republican lawmakers have joined at least one far right group on Facebook, the 5th highest number in the country. And Kent has been criticized for his relationship with white nationalist Nick Fuentes and the Proud Boys. Wicks says this is concerning for moderate Republicans in the state and also for the people targeted by the far right.
We've also seen just the far right extremist, militant, white supremacist beliefs that are really taking hold. It's dangerous for our community as we're riling people up.
Kent has said his association with Fuentes and other far right figures is a non-issue. He says he fought with people of all races and creeds during his 2 decades in the Army. Kent beat out Jamie Herrera Butler, a Republican who voted to impeach Trump for his role in the January 6th insurrection. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo about the newest edition of the paper, the special vendor issue. Then it's Noise Filter, your public health podcast. At 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks, and at 7 p.m., Eco Justice Radio. Your weather for tonight will be clear with an overnight low of 56. Tomorrow's weather, warm, sunny, absolutely perfect with a high of 81. Today in history, in the 2008 financial collapse, the U.S. government took control of the two largest mortgage financing companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And our quote of the day is from American Senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye, who was born today in 1924. Before Kamala Harris was elected vice president, he was the highest-ranking Asian-American politician in U.S. history. He said, quote, "Democracy is an imperfect concept, slowly seeking perfection." A new report shows greater congressional support of pro-democracy bills. Plus, New York City and Texas continue to battle it out over the southern border migrant crisis. With these stories and more, it's Mary Schuerman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's really important for citizens to understand what their elected officials are on key democracy reform issues.
A new democracy scorecard charting support for pro-democracy bills in the 117th Congress found 101 members had perfect scores on issues of voting rights, ending big money in politics, ethics, and the rule of law. Aaron Sherb with Common Cause says it's a 70% increase compared to their 2020 scorecard.
This really shows how much the public is demanding Congress to create fair national standards for voting. So no matter what one's zip code or race or size one's wallet is, everybody should have a fair and equal voice.
However, most of the legislation tracked didn't become law. 1 million migrants from 150 nations have entered the country under the Biden administration, according to data compiled by the New York Times. Most are expected to live in the U.S. for at least 7 years as they wait asylum hearings. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre shot down Texas Senator Ted Cruz's invite for her to visit the border to assess the migrant situation, saying she doesn't need lectures from Republicans about immigration policy.
And I certainly won't take advice on border from anyone who voted against securing record level of funding for the Department of Homeland Security.
Meanwhile, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has spent more than $12 million busing migrants to Chicago, Washington, D.C., and New York City.
These people have gone through so much, are incredibly vulnerable. Governor Abbott is using this for political purposes. He's crossed the line by using human beings to create anti-immigrant and anti-Latino hatred.
Manuel Castro heads up the Office of Immigrant Affairs for New York Mayor Eric Adams, who sent a delegation to meet with Border Patrol officials Tuesday in Texas. White House COVID coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha says new Omicron-specific COVID boosters will be key to controlling a possible false surge in infections.
I really believe this is why God gave us two arms, one for the flu shot and the other one for the COVID shot.
COVID-related hospitalizations are decreasing, but the virus is still killing an average of 375 people per day. Liz Truss became the third female prime minister in the history of the United Kingdom and paid tribute to her predecessor, who resigned after a series of scandals.
Boris Johnson delivered Brexit, the COVID vaccine, and stood up to Russian aggression. History will see him as a hugely consequential prime minister.
In a congratulatory call to Truss, President Joe Biden reaffirmed the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain. The Obamas will reunite with the Bidens at the White House today for the official unveiling of their presidential portraits. The ceremony is traditionally hosted by the former president's immediate predecessor, but was scuttled due to the contentious relationship between former President Trump and former President Obama. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find Ray Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The manhunt for the remaining suspect who stabbed 28 people in Saskatchewan over the weekend is now in its fourth day. The James Smith Cree Nation grieves those 10 people who were lost, including one tribal elder. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The search for the remaining suspect in the stabbing attacks in Saskatchewan over the weekend is now in its fourth day. Meanwhile, as Dan Karpinchuk reports, the James Smith Cree Nation is still in shock and grieving after 10 people were killed and others wounded.
The intense manhunt has again spread to the entire province of Saskatchewan for 30-year-old Miles Sanderson, the remaining suspect. His brother Damien, the other suspect, was found dead Monday on the reserve. A possible sighting of Miles Sanderson on the reserve yesterday proved to be false, and earlier reports that he might be in Regina have not borne out, according to police. But in the James Smith Cree Nation, 120 miles northeast of Saskatoon, relatives of the victims are grieving, many of them for Gloria Burns, a respected elder and a first responder, who was killed when she took the call for help.
My sister was a very caring woman. She had time for everyone and tried her best to look after everyone.
You know, this tragedy that happened here on our land, it's all because of drugs and alcohol.
Police have still not been able to provide details about the motive for the attacks. They say some of the victims appear to have been targeted while others were selected at random. Miles Sanderson has a lengthy criminal record, and according to a parole board document, he has a history of violent offenses, including assault. He now faces three counts of first-degree murder, as well as attempted murder. Police have warned the public to be cautious, adding that he's believed to be armed and dangerous. Meanwhile, three of the victims remain in hospital in critical condition. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Members of the Apache Stronghold, a coalition of Apache people, other Native people, and non-Native allies, held a day of prayer Tuesday in San Francisco as they continue their fight to protect a sacred site from a proposed copper mine. They're seeking a rehearing in their case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco against the U.S. to protect Oak Flat in Arizona from Resolution Copper. Oak Flat is located within National Forest land east of Phoenix and is part of a land swap approved by Congress in 2014 between the federal government and the company. In June, the court ruled 2-1 in favor of the government's decision to transfer Oak Flat to the company, finding it does not burden the religious practices of Apache people. Members of the Apache stronghold say the sacred land is now on the chopping block, and if mined, Oak Flat will be swallowed in a massive crater, ending their religious and traditional practices in the area forever. The case is being considered for a rehearing in front of a full 11-judge court instead of the 3-judge panel. Native Pop recently showcased indigenous music in downtown Rapid City. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keene has more.
Labor Day weekend brought Rapid City its first annual Pop Fest at Main Street Square. It was a full day of music across genres. LaFon Janice is the executive director for Native Pop. She says there's a value to providing performance stages to Native musicians.
The lyrics are amazing and it's relevant to our lives, and we brought in artists from around the country, and then of course we had local artists as well. We all experience a lot of the same social issues. It was really cool to see, and it's good for our youth to be able to see this.
One of those performers was Welby June. He describes his sound as soul music and says engaging with art builds connections.
It's great to have this platform to help the local community see the different facets of Native folk. That's incredibly helpful in building a community relation in Rapid City and around the area.
Janice says Native Pop hopes to make more musical events possible in the future. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 7th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, Antolia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our wonderful members. And if you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, we would love for you to do so. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us at KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, where we'll be interviewing the editor-in-chief of Street Roots about their special vendor issue. Have a great evening.
Dr. Demento, and you are listening to the KBOO News, the only news you need.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector@kboo.org.
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on
to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking with Kay Rambo, the editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about this week's very special vendors edition of the paper. Welcome, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, the vendors issue, what can readers look forward to in this edition of the paper?
A lot of vendor-written content, some vendor art. So, poetry, quite a bit of poetry, a couple of fiction pieces, an opinion column, kind of a little Q&A sort of thing with a handful of vendors, and then a page of visual art created by vendors.
And how often does a vendor's issue of Street Roots come out?
It's not really, at this point, kind of a consistent thing. We do our vendor zines a couple times a year, and so those are all vendor content. And then, the newspaper will publish vendor poetry columns, occasionally news stories that vendors will write kind of as they come up.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between Street Roots and the Street Roots vendors?
So the newspaper is, kind of not a part of the vendor program. Broadly speaking, Street Roots has advocacy, vendor program, and editorial, which is a newspaper. But they are obviously, intrinsically tied to the paper.